Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is St. Louis on the Air.
Find this today after all we've been through with COVID, and there's no kindness or resetting our attitudes towards the earth, and we've been warned and warned again and warned once more. There was a New Yorker online headline, and it was Joy Williams doesn't write for humanity, which I like better.
Because you're not the biggest fan of humanity.
Not a fan.
I'm Sarah Fenske.
The new exhibit at Washington University's Olin Library is all about Joy Williams. The university houses the acclaimed author's papers, and in celebration of her new novel, Harrow, it has highlights from the collection on display. Harrow is beautiful and funny and dark and very odd. It's also a long time in coming. In the year 2000, Joy Williams' last novel, The Quick and the Dead, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Now 21 years and several books later, Joy Williams is finally back to the novel. And she joins us today to tell us about it and also a bit about her papers. So Joy Williams, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
So congratulations on Harrow. Does it feel good to have this out there in the world?
Yes, now it's a beautiful little object. I love the cover. Maybe you can describe the cover.
It is a beautiful cover. I love this green. It's literally my favorite shade of green.
Harrow green.
Harrow green. And it has here a horse, and the horse looks like he's maybe in a little bit of distress. Am I projecting based on my reading of the novel?
Well, the horse appears off and on in the novel. Also, stones with holes in them that everybody likes. Everybody would like stones, they're sacred stones. But the way the artist has rendered it, it looks more as though he's sort of tangled up in some, you know, chemical oil spill, which I like.
You
it's,
like, yeah.
It's just a good book. I hope the contents are judged in the same way.
Yeah. No, it is a good book. It's also, as I mentioned, it's kind of a dark book. It's funny, but it's dark. The Atlantic titled its review, Joy Williams Imagines the Death of the World. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, I like, there was a New Yorker online headline, and it was Joy Williams doesn't write for humanity, which I like better.
Because you're not the biggest fan of humanity.
Not a fan, but I think that's very intriguing. I have some theories about where fiction should go now. I think we're at a crisis point, as we are in so many subjects, but I think the novel has to change, and I think it will. I mean, more of a responsibility toward what we've done to the earth and how we can how we can live with. But this is one thing that bothers me about climate change. It's adaptation, or it's not. There hasn't been any moment where we've sat down and thought, why have we come to this point? This is terrible. Mm-hmm. We're all so involved. No, it's all about just building better, building smarter.
We're not thinking about our culpability.
No, and. I mean, in the exhibition at the university, there's what do I have in there about guilt? How much I like guilt or something? Guilt.
Yeah, you write from guilt. Yeah.
I write from guilt, and I think people should be guiltier.
There should be more guilt in the world.
And I should introduce our second guest here today. This is Joel Miner. He's the curator of the Modern Literature Collection and Manuscripts at Washington University Libraries. So guilt is a major topic for Joy Williams.
Yeah, and we put that on the wall next to her nonfiction case because so much of that is about the destruction of the environment, our mistreatment of animals. And so it was a fitting place for that.
So I want to talk more about the exhibition in just a moment. I want to go back to the guilt that we should feel, because I'm a Catholic. That's an important topic for me, too. Let's wallow in our guilt here today. This is a quote from your novel. You write, "For all intents and purposes, the apocalypse had pretty much occurred. The incomprehensible beauty of nature was no more. But most had accepted the destitution done in their name. It was over, and now it could begin," was the way those on the outside justified their refreshed complacency. Is that about us today?
Yes. Thank you so much for pulling that out of the book. I mean, that's very succinct.
It's a wonderful paragraph.
How do you do this?
I mean, you did that.
Yes, very much. I was just watching CNN this morning, and it was some guy who was going to run for governor of Pennsylvania, and he kept talking about broadband. Broadband. This is what he was going to do. He was going to bring broadband. He must have mentioned it 3 or 4 times. I mean, we're in just, it's broadband. I don't care about, well, maybe some people do. Maybe the voters really, really care about broadband.
They might in rural Pennsylvania.
Instead of their water, or instead of, you know, their children, what the future is going to be for them. But anyway, I shouldn't have brought this. Well, I shouldn't have brought politics into this.
No, but I thought politics are very much into this. But so in this novel, the people I liked best in this novel were this ragtag group of elderly troublemakers, revolutionaries, terrorists, you could call them, where they go around trying to strike a blow for the environment. But their efforts are comical to me. They were somewhat comical. They were pathetic in some cases. Is there futility in trying to do something?
They were so elderly.
It was too late, maybe.
And they had participated, really, in, you know, they were elderly eco-terrorists. Without hope of changing. But they wanted to destroy the recovery recovery effort.
And do you find
broadband.
Is that admirable that these elderly people in this novel wanted to go out and just destroy?
Yeah, blow up car dealerships and, you know, the United States Navy and, you know, the horrors that they inflict on mammal life under the seas and all. But you're right, they're not effective.
I mean, the way that you describe this, I feel bad that I found them so funny. Mm-hmm. Was I meant to, in some ways, find them funny? Okay.
When I gave a reading last night, and I read a little section from Harrow, it's the part where there's a birthday party at a bowling alley for a 10-year-old boy, and it's supposed to be funny. The ending isn't, but it's supposed to be funny. And nobody was, like, chuckling or laughing. And then people claimed afterwards, "I was, but you couldn't hear me through my mask," you know. So
did you scold them a little bit for not laughing?
Afterwards, I said, why weren't you laughing at this?
So, Joel Miner, I have to ask, because I did laugh a lot reading this book. Did you laugh, or did you have to acknowledge the bigger point, which is not funny?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. There are so many funny lines and scenario scenes, like the bowling alley scene. But it is, you know, it's kind of an uncomfortable laugh, I guess I would say, because of the overall themes of the book and what you have to grasp with in it, because it is very much about us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely, I've heard some people posit that this is set in the future. I wasn't even sure if it was the future.
No.
It felt like maybe the future, like this could be 2 months from now, that kind of future.
Yeah, exactly. The apocalypse has come and gone, and 1/3 of the world is gone, but they can function with the other 2/3. I mean, and they, you know, Disney World and
bowling alleys.
And the bowling alleys are all up and running. You know, there's cars, huge car dealerships that still exist. So, and I find this today, after all we've been through with COVID, and there's no kindness or resetting our attitudes towards the earth. And we've been warned and warned again and warned once more, you know.
So, Joel, these are very important subjects. These are very serious subjects. How much is Harrow front and center in this exhibition at the Washington University's Olin Libraries?
Yeah. Joy was very nice enough to send us some typescript drafts of the book, as well as a letter and an uncorrected proof. So we were able to put that in along with all of the rest of the archive. So I feel like it starts with her childhood and goes all the way up to the current day.
And I should mention, we are talking today to the acclaimed author Joy Williams. Her new book, Harrow, is her first novel in 21 years. We're also joined today by Joel Miner. He's the curator of the Modern Literature Collection and Manuscripts at Washington University Libraries. Its new exhibition is called Joy Williams, Honored Guest. What do you mean by honored guest in that title?
Well, I took that straight from her her third collection of short stories. And I just felt like it was the really appropriate because we wanted to not only celebrate her new novel, but just celebrate her papers being at Washington University and how much she means to us, not only in the special collections, but as a teacher through the years in the English department, the MFA program for fiction writers, and specifically, she's beloved there.
And Joy, I have to ask, how did this idea of housing your papers at Washington University, how did that come about, and why there?
I am really connected, oddly, with St. Louis. I've been here many times. I love the park and the art museum, and I've had my dogs here, and I have still have some close friends here. And so it seemed an obvious place, and it's a wonderful place. I mean, William Gaddis, William Gass, I mean, James Merrill, Tennessee Williams. And I had, today, I saw Joel arrange to have a few boxes of William Gaddis's papers, J.R., specifically dealing with J.R., brought up. And it was so thrilling for me to look at that. And then they even brought up one of his typewriters. And so it's a wonderful, wonderful place to go. And the staff is lovely. And if you're serious about a writer, I mean, you can actually see how their mind was working or not working on a specific page.
So, Joy, you're there. The big exhibition is all about you. But you're combing through other writers' archives.
I could have stayed there for ever looking through Mr. Gaddis's papers, you know, and it's a lot of fun and so beautifully, you know, presented. I was a little alarmed actually when Joel introduced me yesterday, and he was like quoting things from what they had found going through the papers I'd given. Apparently, I hadn't combed through them quite as perhaps
you turned over a little too much
extensively as as I might have, but.
Do you remember something that stood out to you where you're like, oh, boy, I didn't know that was in there?
I know. Oh, yes, yeah. A few things. Oh, can I tell the funny thing about the Vintage Contemporary from Breaking and Entering? Yeah. This is a novel, third novel. When was it? The 80s?
Late 80s, 89.
They were promoting it. Vintage Contemporary was promoting it as sort of a beach book. And they wrapped it in plastic with a pair of sunglasses, black sunglasses in it. And I'd carried around this. I hadn't carried it around, but I had this copy. And I gave it to Joel. You know, 30 years, these sunglasses have been in plastic wrap in the Breaking and Entering. And I look in the exhibit, and I say, where did you get that pair of sunglasses? And he just opened the plastic, taken the sunglasses out, and propped it in one of the, on the shelves. And I was like, what kind of curator? I mean,
in our defense, it was just snapshots. It's a snap that snapped right open. So.
Okay, you didn't have to destroy anything to get the sunglasses out.
I didn't destroy plastic. I hope you recycled the
My
plastic.
My reputation is on the line here.
That's right.
So, Joel, that's something that stood out to Joy when she's looking at this exhibit. What, as you're combing through Joy's papers, has stood out to you?
Well, most of all are the TypeScript drafts, and, you know, one thing that I love about Joy's archive is she still writes on the typewriter, and so she creates these beautiful drafts that students and scholars and fans can come in and see the evolution of the story, of the novel.
You're not just deleting when there's a paragraph you don't like. You'd have to strike that out or throw that page away.
Scotch tape, scissors, you know.
You're cutting and pasting paragraphs. Yes. Wow. That seems like that makes things a lot harder.
Well, no, I can't imagine working on a computer or anything. I would think that would be so confusing.
Because you came up typing and just stuck with it.
Right, right. And to me, but it does, it's a lot of cutting out. I've got these you know, lots of Scotch tape dispensers. I've got them everywhere. Laramie, Tucson, Maine, you know, with the Scotch tape.
You're keeping Scotch in business.
I'm always prepared for, you know, if I have to cut something.
And so, Joel, as people are looking at this, at the exhibit, they can see how a paragraph or how a page has evolved.
Exactly, yeah. And I should mention, we have an online version of the exhibit, which we have more pages from that typescript that you may not see in the case, and so you can even really see that evolution of the editing, and it's just amazing. The other thing I would mention are the files of correspondence with other writers. You know, Joy is associated with so many other giants in American literature that are there in that archive.
Who are some of the writers we see her corresponding
well,
with?
Well, Don DeLillo is a big one, and Raymond Carver, Annie Dillard, and William Gass. I could go on.
I wonder, though, about, you know, so many of us who are, you know, communicating with each other through email or, God forbid, even through text, where there's not going to be the records of this correspondence back and forth. Does that kind of break your heart as a curator?
It does, and that's why, you know, that's what I love about Joy's archive, is I feel like it's a real physical archive. Not that there's anything wrong with, you know, we do digital archiving as well. We have great staff working on that, and so that's the reality of most writers these days, but it's great to have this to work with. For those reasons.
And so, Joy, you're a fan of these other writers' work and looking through their archives, and you're getting a glimpse of this. Do you worry that going forward, all we're going to have is some Google Doc where somebody has deleted everything that they didn't like? There is no cut and paste. It's all just, you know, with a stroke, it's gone.
Or you have to bring the FBI in, right, to reconstruct. No, I can't imagine. Yeah, I think it's really sad. I mean, the Paris Review in the old days always used to have a typescript in front of their interviews. I don't know what they do now, with young writers. But a lot of writers, they love the typewriter too. It's a new discovery to them, and
it feels more tactile.
They have one. Yeah.
So speaking of the typewriter, this reminds me of this great interview you did with LitHub, where you answered your questions by typing them and mailing them, and then they published. You could see your type in one place. You even sort of added a little note here where you'd missed a word and you wrote it in.
Isn't that funny? I mean, it took so long to do that. They were so patient and so nice about it. Can you imagine doing it like that?
I mean,
that?
This went on for months.
Typing it out, sending it by mail, and this was even before the post office decided to roll back a couple of days on, you know, first class postage.
Yeah, I imagine most interviewers wouldn't do it that way.
No. Yeah, that was very nice. And it was all around a new typewriter I'd bought, a Hermes, from the 60s in some junk store in northern New Mexico. And so I rescued that typewriter.
Do you feel that having a different typewriter and the different feel of the keys, that ends up changing the writing that you do?
Well, you know, I'm not a good typist. I type with one hand, one finger. I have never really learned how to type.
That seems like an occupational hazard.
It doesn't go fast. I have this one, yes, it's short. It's getting shorter and shorter, my finger. But you'd think I would have learned. I do know how to change the ribbon.
Okay,
you know.
This is important. Yeah. You don't have to get a new typewriter every time.
Can't change the ribbon. But I'm not a good typist. I just, maybe I should, you know, take some lessons or something. Maybe things would go much more smoothly. It wouldn't take 21 years, for example.
Well, it's hard to dispute the method that brought us this wonderful novel.
Oh,
so,
thank you.
Joy Williams, I know interviews are not your favorite thing, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. You've been lovely. Thank you.
And that book is Harrow, if you want to read the work of Joy Williams for yourself. Joel Miner, I also want to thank you for joining us today. Joel is the curator of the Modern Literature Collection and Manuscripts at Washington University Libraries.
Yeah, thank you.
This episode was produced by Evie Hemphill, with audio engineering by Aaron Dorr and production assistance from Jane Mather Glass. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron. Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here. Do you find
find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.